Today on Main Street, we are addressing a topic that weighs heavy on many hearts, suicide prevention. In North Dakota and across the country, families, friends, and communities are struggling with the painful reality of losing loved ones to suicide. This conversation is about offering hope, shedding light on warning signs, and sharing the support systems that are here to help you right here in North Dakota. If you or someone you care about are in crisis, please know that you are not alone. Reach out now by dialing 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Your life matters, and help is just a phone call away. Is it important to talk about this? Well, the suicide rate in North Dakota is greater than the national average, and this is not a statistic that we want to lead in. Joining me to discuss this important topic are Samantha Christofferson. She's the Executive Director of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention for North and South Dakota. Melissa Markegaard, she's North Dakota's Health and Human Services Suicide Prevention Administrator. Chad Pitts from ND Hopes, he's a Program Manager. Sarah Kemp-Tobbitt, she's with the Fargo VA, and she is the Community Engagement and Partnerships Coordinator. And Sean Abbas, he's the Public Affairs Officer with the Fargo VA. To all of you, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having us.
You're sure welcome. Let's start with the North Dakota Governor's Challenge.
So I'd love to talk about the Governor's Challenge. The Governor's Challenge is a partnership among the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, so SAMHSA, and the state of North Dakota to bring together community members, community leaders, and state agencies to prevent suicide among our service members, veterans, and their families. So we have three priority areas that we work on in the Governor's Challenge. The first is priority area one is identifying our service members, veterans, and their families and screening for suicide risk. So we can't help our SMVF, service members, veterans, and their families, if we don't know who they are. So one of the things we're doing is trying to find those folks in their local communities and providing community provider education on how to find them. You know, if it's a veteran or service member coming into a local emergency room unless we ask. The second priority area is promoting connectedness and care transitions. So how we're doing that as a Governor's Challenge team is promoting a toolkit that our community providers can use. One of the things that we know about veterans is not all of them are using VA for whatever reason. They are seeing community providers at their local clinics, at their local mental health centers. And so if a veteran is identified as a veteran and they want to get involved in VA or access VA healthcare services, we're providing them a toolkit on how to do that, kind of taking the government red tape out of accessing the VA. And then our third priority area is lethal means safety. So promoting gun locks and medicine safe storage for all SMVF and their families. The VA specifically will give out free gun locks to any veteran or service member or family that requests. And then we're also promoting counseling on access to lethal means to service providers throughout North Dakota. So that is training our primary care physicians, mental health providers, how to have those conversations with folks who are facing a potential suicide crisis about how to voluntarily and temporarily store firearms and medications in safe ways during that acute crisis.
What unique challenges, panel, does North Dakota face regarding suicide rates compared to other states? What do we know about why suicide rates are higher for rural folks, perhaps, than folks who live in communities?
There is definitely stigma around mental health and suicide prevention. We know that more people are coming forward and getting involved than ever before. More people are telling their stories. More people are getting involved. But we still have stigma in these rural communities. So it's really important that we continue having these conversations, right? Rome wasn't built in a day. We have to continue having these programs, these conversations. And with that, we'll change that culture around mental health. I also know that there's so many great organizations across the state of North Dakota that are doing great work. We just need to collaborate and communicate with each other so people know about these resources. We know that suicide rates are higher in rural communities, one, because of the stigma around getting that help and support that they need. We also know, looking at the data, that men die by suicide at a much higher rate. Women attempt at a higher rate, but men die by suicide at a higher rate. And some of these reasons why we think it is this way is because it's more culturally appropriate for women to seek help and not so much for men. So that's why we're, again, trying to change that culture. Having conversations, getting that help and support is the brave, smart thing to do, and we want to encourage that. We know that in North Dakota and in men specifically, looking at the data, men usually use much more lethal means. And that's why firearm safety education and suicide prevention go hand in hand. And it's important that we have these conversations around safe storage and suicide prevention within the community.
So this is Melissa with North Dakota Health and Human Services. And during last legislative session, several things were passed related to suicide prevention, one of them being a VEL-E care is what it's called. And it's for law enforcement, and they can get iPads that when they respond to a behavioral health call, those law enforcement professionals, they're professionals in law enforcement, but they're not professionals in behavioral health. And so the contract with Avell eCare is to kind of fill that particular gap where if it's a behavioral health crisis, that law enforcement official responding can use the iPad to connect with a behavioral health professional, figure out how to help this person, maybe without transporting. This is in real time, and it's great, but the whole focus was to have that be rural so that a law enforcement official in Bowman County could utilize that.
What would you tell folks who are very nervous about reaching out, maybe for the first time in their lives, about asking for help?
Yeah, so this is Chad with ND Hopes, and especially for veterans, I mean, we've been trained to suck it up and soldier on. That is the mentality. So the stigma is there that we don't need help. And in reality, it's okay to take a knee and rely on one of your battle buddies for help. That is perfectly okay. And we can't be there for each other if we're not there to help ourselves. If we're not well, we cannot help our battle buddies. So taking care of yourself should be first and foremost so you can help your friends. So I would say calling 988 is extremely important, but even before you get to the point of crisis, because 988 can help you get connected to resources that can be more of an upstream prevention instead of all of a sudden you are at the point of crisis and you immediately need help.
That's a very, very important point. It's not for just at the very, very, very worst moment, right?
Exactly.
What help is available for Native Americans? Are there systems in place that we should all know about and understand that can be helpful?
So going back to, again, resources in rural communities, I wanted to come back to that and then I'll come for a circle. So there are wonderful organizations in North Dakota that are doing great work across the state. It's just really important that we're sharing resources and collaborating with each other. So I wanted to add that as well, talking about the stigma around mental health. It's also important that we know, the statistics are there. Statistics are higher in Indigenous populations. And it's important that we provide resources, trainings, and tools and really collaborate so that we can help, reduce those numbers. And it's also really important that, again, we're bringing in all of these resources and collaborating together.
Melissa, when somebody dials 988, what happens?
Here in North Dakota, when you dial 988, you are routed to First Link. First Link is a nonprofit. They're located here in Fargo, but they also answer the 211 hotline, and then they have always answered the suicide lifeline, but it hasn't always been called 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. So, when we're looking at the numbers and what they're receiving for 988 calls now, calls are up, but I think there's multiple things that have led to that. With the start of 988, that three-digit number, they also created chat and text. So that's just two additional ways that you can reach 988, which is so important. So I think when you're looking at, plus the fact that it's only three digits now, more people are calling, does that mean that we have more mental health? I do not believe so. I believe that more people are able to remember 988 because they can chat, they can text, they can call that number. It's very short. But I also think that more people are, like Chad said, willing to reach out when they're not too crisis yet. You can call 988 if you're not suicidal. You do not have to be suicidal to call. We just put out a story about one of the 988 call specialists. He took a call from a supervisor of a oil rig person or something like that. You know, like he only supervises men for the most part. And he was seeing warning signs in a gentleman that he was supervising, but he didn't know that he was looking at warning signs, but he was a little bit concerned about this person. And so he ended up calling 988 because he knew this guy was in the middle of a divorce. He was losing custody of his kids. He was really withdrawing. He wasn't taking it. He was quiet at work and he never used to be, all of this stuff. And so the supervisor called 988, which is exactly what we want people to do when they're not sure what to do, but they think they're looking at something that could potentially be a crisis. And what can I do to help this person? And the first line call, the call specialist was able to answer his questions and to kind of work through how he should approach this situation. And probably, maybe he saved that guy's life. You never know. But I think, you know, when you call 988, you can expect to talk to someone who is very well trained. They want to have a conversation with you. They might do some breathing exercises with you or teach you how to get through that moment of crisis. They're there to support you and to talk with you. And I think it's important also because not everybody is, and we'll go back to rural. So if you're living rural and you know everybody in your community, you don't want to necessarily talk about all your issues, you know, all your issues, heaven forbid. We all have issues, but it's hard. You don't want everybody to know about them. And that's understandable, which is the beauty of 988, because they don't know you. You know, you can tell them all the issues and they're there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's confidential. It's free. Geolocation stuff just went into effect for Verizon and T-Mobile. Now, Verizon and T-Mobile, if you are in North Dakota and you call 988, your area code is not 701. That no longer matters if you're Verizon or T-Mobile, because if you're, say you're in Jamestown and you call 988 and you're Verizon or T-Mobile, you will go to the North Dakota Call Center, which is great news because then they can give that person calling different resources that they can use here.
We're glad to have this conversation about suicide prevention. Joining me is Sam Christofferson. She's the Executive Director of American Foundation for Suicide Prevention for North and South Dakota. Melissa Markegaard, she's North Dakota's Health and Human Services Suicide Prevention Administrator. Chad Pitts, he's a program manager with ND Hopes. Sarah Kemp Tabbitt, she's with the Fargo VA and is the Community Engagement and Partnerships Coordinator. And Sean Abbas, he's the Public Affairs Officer with the Fargo VA Healthcare System. I want to talk about 988 and then option one with Sarah and Sean. That's an important option that veterans need to know about, I think.
So this is Sarah. Absolutely. So 988 is the number that everybody needs to remember, regardless of veteran or service member status. So in North Dakota, as Melissa mentioned, if you dial 988 and hang on the line, you'll get connected locally here with First Link. If you are in North Dakota or really anywhere else in the United States, you call 988 and press 1, you'll get the Veterans Crisis Line. The Veterans Crisis Line is managed nationally by the VA. The responders to the Veterans Crisis Line are VA-trained responders, a lot of them veterans themselves. who can provide crisis intervention, just listening and support if someone were to need it. And then it's ultimately, it is 24/7 linked to your local VA. So if I'm a veteran, I'm having a rough night, I'd really like my therapist to know, my VA therapist to know, I can call 988 at 3 a.m, press 1, get connected to the Veterans Crisis Line. And then the suicide prevention team at my local VA will be alerted. And then the suicide prevention team will give me a call, follow up with me, see what other needs I might have. And if I'd like to let my therapist know that, hey, maybe I'd like a sooner appointment or this is going on with me. It's also a way that veterans who don't have mental health care with the VA can find out if they're eligible and find out if they can get established with mental health care, primary health care, really anything that we have at the VA. They can do that again 24/7 through the Veterans Crisis Line, 988 press 1.
Just again, that it's something that we need to utilize more as veterans and try and get rid of that stigma that we don't need help, that we should shoulder everything and throw our rucksack on and go on a ruck and be okay. And that's just not the reality of it. We all need battle buddies, and 988 is essentially the battle buddy.
One of the most powerful interviews that I had while I was in Wyoming was with a group in Cheyenne, Wyoming, who was created to support families from the moment after a suicide happened and beyond. And we're talking moments or hours after and beyond. What happens in North Dakota relative to support that's available for families who have just so tragically lost a loved one? Sam, is that something you can comment about?
Yes. So it's really important that suicide loss survivors know that there is support, there's community, they're not alone in their grief. When my family needed resources, we felt like we were on an island all by ourselves. We couldn't talk about it. And then that's definitely not the case. We want suicide loss survivors to know that they have community, they have resources. Some simple resources that I would like to share, you can go to AFSP.org/loss. There's really great information about how to get connected to these resources. Also information that's really helpful. What do I write in the obituary? What do I tell people? Why are the police here? Why, you know, some of those really complex questions that we wouldn't think about unless it's happening to us is incredibly helpful. Also, again, the healing process, it's really important that loss survivors know they're not alone. So we have this great program in North Dakota. It's called Healing Conversations. So if a family is recently bereaved, they can reach out to an AFSP trained volunteer, but they're also a loss survivor themselves. So they are talking to someone who has been through it, knows this, the uniqueness of the grief. And really they're just there to support them and show you're not alone in this. You have community. Again, that's the Healing Conversations program. And then we also have International Survivors of Suicide Loss Day events. These are events that happen across across the nation and across the state, but we're going to be hosting 6 of these events in November. It's always the Saturday before Thanksgiving. This might be the first year that suicide loss survivors have a holiday season without their loved one. So this is a mini healing conference where loss survivors can come, heal, get connected, and talk to fellow suicide loss survivors and know that they're not alone in their grief. So again, some of those highlighted programs, you can find this information at afsp.org/loss. Healing Conversations is a really great program if you've lost loved ones to suicide. And then also International Survivors of Suicide Loss Day events, which this year will be November 23rd. And we'll be hosting them in multiple sites across the state.
I'd like to go around the room for your best advice, each of you, on what individuals in North Dakota can do maybe to better recognize the warning signs of suicide, like that oil field supervisor did that Melissa spoke about just a little bit earlier. What can they do? And again, what's the best way for us to get immediate help to folks who really, really need it? Melissa, can I start with you with that question?
This is my favorite question, because I really think, you know, when we start talking about warning signs, I think a lot of us have heard warning signs like, you know, they're withdrawing, they're depressed, you know, they're struggling with their mental health, they're giving away their possessions. They might say words like, I'd be better off you would be better off without me here, or I'd be better off if I wasn't here, those types of things. So those are really in your face type warning signs that I think I really feel if we're going to prevent some of these suicide deaths from occurring, we really need to be paying attention. In this social media age of Facebook and Instagram, and you're constantly knowing what's happening in people's lives. And I think, you know, the more we know, the more we can help sometimes. And so if we know that, say, a family member or an acquaintance, a family friend, say you know that they are going through a divorce, or that their wife just left them, or that their divorce is finalized this coming week and he's going to lose custody of his kids, or she got a DUI last week and now that's going to put her, like, she could potentially lose her job because she got this DUI. Those types of things are the life crises that I like to talk about, and I like to point out to people, like, that person is at an increased risk of suicide. And so you, as a family friend or a family member, you knowing that, reach out to them. Let them know you see them. Acknowledge that their situation is hard, and you know it, and you see them, and you're worried. And, you know, I mean, I think in some of those types of situations, maybe they had an arrest and it was just like this weird, like, ah, you know, I mean, you just never know. But I think in those situations, acknowledging that this is a really challenging thing that they're going through, I bet you feel alone, I want you to know you're not alone, type thing, that reaching out. And I don't like to use the term Minnesota, North Dakota nice, because I just think it's like, meh. Are we, like, you need to be nice and you need to do that. But also, when you see someone who could potentially be struggling, those are the people that you need to reach out to, and you need to make sure that they know that they are seen. And I think sometimes just acknowledging that with them, that I see you and I know that this is so, so, so hard, that can make all the difference to someone who is struggling and feels like they're on an island and that nobody cares right now.
Sam, what would you add to that?
Very nicely said, Melissa. A few things that we like to educate people on is knowing the warning signs, right? So we want to look for changes in talk, behavior, and mood. We want to look out for those things so that we can have these strong conversations. So we do a lot of training around that so people feel more comfortable. But I would say, trust your gut, trust your instincts. If this is a time where you feel like something just seems off with someone, or something doesn't seem right, that's a sign that you need to have an honest, caring conversation. And just to echo what Melissa said, she gave great examples of, you know, when to have these conversations. And I'd also like to remind people that it doesn't have to be this big, beautiful, poetic speech. It's a conversation is a time to show that you care. So if at any point you just trust it in your gut, like, this, something might be wrong, I need to say this again, we need to have these conversations. We need to normalize these conversations. The more that we talk about this, the more people will feel supported. And when we're talking to someone that we are worried about, this is a time to listen with care and concern. Even though we're nervous, we're gonna stop talking and we're gonna listen to see about their level of distress. And this is a time where we want to ask directly about suicide. We want to ask directly about suicidal thoughts. We don't want to be afraid to say the word suicide. We know that it's safe. It's based on research. We know that it's safest to talk directly and ask that question. I know there used to be a myth around suicide prevention that if you talked directly, it would plant the seed. I can assure you that's so far from the truth. We want to ask directly if someone is thinking about suicide. And if they say no, they're still going to feel supported knowing that you took the time to have this conversation. And if they say yes, don't freak out, right? This is a time to know your resources and get that person to that help and support that they need. You can always call 988, no matter what day it is, no matter what time it is, 988 is always available.
For veterans, as we wrap up our conversation today, what would you add?
I think I would just look at this as kind of a multi-part thing. Like, one great thing that we have as North Dakota is that North Dakotans truly care about other North Dakotans. It's just we have this stigma, this wall up, like others have said, where we don't want to talk about mental health. And then that's even more so in our veteran community. So if we rely on our neighbors, on our friends, on our families, and open up to have these conversations, then we can really start to see some positive change, because we already rely on our friends and family members for so much in North Dakota. We have this natural protective factor towards suicide built into our communities, but we don't tap into it because we have this stigma. And then also I'd like to add that getting trained as a community member, bringing a training into your organization.
A faith member even?
A faith member, yeah, exactly. I mean, everyone here on this group today has trainings within their organizations, specifically for certain demographics. One of the ones that ND Hopes offers is QPR, which is question, persuade, refer. It's like CPR. We all agree that CPR is a good thing to do. QPR is the same thing. It's how to talk to that person, how to recognize the warning signs, and how to refer.
It's important to talk about it and not to ignore this such an important issue. I've been pleased to be joined by Samantha Christofferson, Melissa Markigard, Chad Pitts, Sarah Kemp Tabbitt, and Sean Abbas. And Sean, I want to thank you for your assistance in bringing this panel together. To all of you, thank you so much for joining me on Main Street.
Support for Brave Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, a consumer-owned generation and transmission cooperative, and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with over 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured. Tour the studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists during the FM Visual Artists Studio Crawl. This free event is October 5th and 6th, noon to 6 p.m. See new and returning artists demonstrating their work. New destinations this year include the Indigenous Art Collaboration at the Plains Art Museum, and the Rourke Art Gallery is offering tours of their public access print studio and hosting several area artists in their courtyard outside. Find the studio crawl map at prairiepublic.org/community.
Rex Wilder is an award-winning poet, photographer, and mental breakdown survivor turned mental health advocate. Rex, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your book, A Quiet Place to Land, has been called a mental wellness coffee table book by the National Alliance on Mental Health and details the beauty and connection you found in photos during healing walks. Let's start right there. Tell me about why you felt it helpful to write A Quiet Place to Land.
I think this needs to begin when I was hospitalized with my mental breakdown. They locked me up twice. Then I went into treatment for 4 months. It was pretty serious. I'm 68 years old now. I had never had any issues with mental illness at all. And out of nowhere, this happened. So frankly, I was pretty scared. And I was not residential. I lived at home, and every day to feel better, and this is part of my secret, I would stand up from whatever I was doing when I would feel the need, and I'd take a long walk. I'd bring my dog and I'd bring my camera, and I inevitably felt better. I did this through the Venice canals and ended up with a lot of pictures of canoes and houses and flowers, and most of all, these beautiful birds, these egrets. And most of the book are these photos of egrets that at the time I was doing it pretty much to ground myself, just to feel okay. And that's why the interesting title. It's a book filled with photographs of birds, but it's about landing.
You talk about photography and digital overpainting. First, what is digital overpainting, and how did it help you kind of reframe your experiences?
Well, I didn't even know the phrase until my publishers turned me on to it. But basically, it's a fancy name for cheating. I would have the photos. They wouldn't look right. They wouldn't replicate what I was feeling. They wouldn't be enough. Like, I would be walking through the canals, and I maybe felt an epiphany, or I maybe got happy for no reason and felt amazing. And then I'd look at the photos, and they would look like, no offense to Venice, but it might have looked like a sewer, or it might have looked like not the finest of days. And I would take the photos back, and I would digitally overpaint. I would say the photos aren't good enough. They don't communicate what I felt. They won't help anyone looking at them. That's how I started developing that. My editor said I was digitally overpainting and that I was a pictorialist. They sent me back to the early 20th century. and showed me many of the photographers who specifically messed with their photos to give it more of a verisimilitude, and they would mess with them. That's what ended up happening, and I started getting, not only inside of me, but outside, I started getting quite a reaction in a positive way to these photos that I had enhanced.
You shared a question that I believe you claim really has helped you on your path to recovery, and that question is, where will you be when happiness finds you? How did that question come about, and how did it change your outlook in life, and how can others use it to help themselves?
It's an interesting question. It pretty much is one of those open-ended phrases that promises that happiness will find you, whoever you are out there. When you ask that question, where will you be when happiness finds you? It talks about a journey, but everyone's journey is different. I ask the question, where will you be when happiness finds you? It could be on a walk. It could be home. It could be sitting with someone you care about. It could be in the most unlikely of places. It could be on a bus. It could be anywhere. And I left it open-ended this way in my little cheat sheet of aphorisms, because I wanted people to ask themselves, including myself, because I can't tell anyone where they will be when happiness finds them, only that it's going to happen. It will happen.
What I liked about that phrase was it's, where am I going to be when the other shoe drops, right? Where am I going to be when something negative again comes my way? This is an expectation. This is an expectation that good is also going to come our way, and we need to be open to it.
Yes, absolutely.
Rex, as someone who has contemplated suicide, and it's such a difficult topic to visit about, we spoke about it in the first half of our show with many different folks in North Dakota that want to help, that are ready to help those who are just feeling down. But my question to you is, what advice would you give to someone who maybe today are feeling that they are just at the lowest point and can't see a way out? What would you tell them?
Well, my advice would be what people told me. I was in treatment, and I was being treated for everything. They intake you, and then they decide what's wrong with you later. And I asked someone, probably 2 months into my treatment, hey, didn't I come here for depression as well as other things? And they said, yeah. I said, well, no one's telling me how to get out of depression. I know how to get out of anxiety, out of PTSD, out of trauma. But what is it, other than medication, of course? And I kept on hearing the same thing. Besides the word small victories, it was connection. Go out and connect yourself with people, with the world. Do anything but isolate. And it became my homework to turn to the right and the left in treatment and say, hey, let's go do something. Here I was trying to recover from my suicidal ideation, my hospitalization. And I would say, hey, let's go to the Hollywood Bowl. Let's go get our fortunes told. Let's go take a walk. Let's do anything. And that is what most amazingly began to help me, was just getting up, walking out. It's become kind of a mantra for me, which is to get up from the table and go outside. But not only to be with nature, but to be with people. Be with people, connect with people, talk with people. Even when you don't have anything to say, it makes you feel connected. It makes you feel like you're conducting energy between you and someone else. And what eventually happened with me in particular, because I didn't contemplate suicide, it's almost as if suicide contemplated me. I felt my brain disengaging. It was not the way it is for everyone, but it was the way for me. And I found one day through the practice of connecting, of going out, of doing things, of being in the world and not isolating, one day, like Christmas tree lights, I was better. It was that fast. It was in a minute. It was in a minute after months and months of doing that. One day, all the pieces connected, and it was miraculous. And I felt very blessed, very grateful, because it's not this way with everyone. It's very tough, as you know, to prevent suicide, to fight with suicide. Many people come back again and again with attempts, with recoveries. So all I can do is communicate what happened to me and how lucky I was. And that might lead to some other commentary later on in this interview, which is why I ended up becoming a mental health advocate.
We'll talk about that in just a moment, Rex, but I do want to add one thing right here to our listeners. If you are anyone you care about is in crisis, please know, like Rex said, there is someone to reach out to right now, and you can do that by calling 988. It's the Suicide Crisis and Lifeline. Your life matters. Help is just a call away, and take Rex's advice. Reach out. Rex, let's talk about your work as on the board of directors for MAPLE, the MAPLE Counseling Center. It really shows your commitment to helping others. And what do you think, I guess, are the key elements in providing effective mental health support, especially for those who may not have access to professional help?
Well, I think what made me begin to do my work here at MAPLE Counseling Center was when I was sitting around in a circle. We were at the lowest of the low at PCH where I was getting treatment. I said to myself, you know, if I ever get out of here alive, I'm going to devote my life. It's similar with a lot of survivors. There's a lot of bargaining going on. And I had everything before I got my treatment. I had friends. I had family. I had money. Most people don't have at least one of the three. And so we began this work that I'm doing now at MAPLE Counseling Center, where all you do is you knock on the door and you say, I'm in trouble. I'm not okay. And you make that first step and we'll take you the rest of the way. We'll take your hand and we won't let go. And I think this is necessary because that was the luck I had. No one let go of me, even when it looked like it wasn't going to turn out well for me. No one let go. People were checking on options for me. This needs to be available to everyone. And that's behind the direction that we're pursuing here.
Rex Wilder, he's an award-winning poet, photographer, and a mental breakdown survivor turned mental health advocate. His book is A Quiet Place to Land. Rex, you talk about how nature offers silent empathy and that it won't abandon you, even in dark moments. And what would you tell individuals who maybe want to incorporate nature into their daily lives as a mental health tool, even if they live in a city setting?
I think the idea of nature as healing is quite mysterious. All I know is that there's proof upon proof upon proof that it works, that just by stepping out, and you can step out in the busiest street in New York City. Again, it's the same thing that I was speaking about before. It's this idea of connecting. It's almost, if you can commune, it sounds silly, you can roll your eyes, but if you can commune with whatever's right in front of you, whether it's a tree, whether it's a car, whether it's a dog walking down the street, if you can just reach out and connect, you're already getting outside of yourself. And that is something that has been shown to heal people. And it doesn't go away because I think I wrote somewhere that each person is in charge of change. So as long as I know when I go outside, whatever's there, I can commune with it. I can connect with it. I can have a dialogue with it. And many people would say, well, that's not sane. You can't have a dialogue with an inanimate object, but you can. And that kind of thing works, and it hasn't quite been explained, but it does work. And it's what I would suggest to anyone.
Rex, we've asked you to share a poem that you have written. Would you be willing to do that with us?
Sure, absolutely. It would be an honor. This poem is called Learned to Live, and I chose it because it describes the latter part of my healing, and it talks about friendship, and it talks about bonds, and it talks about the good luck. And this is tough to talk about, but everyone that I was friends with in some way this isn't a good word, but they had failed to kill themselves. Someone somehow had stopped them, luckily, and they were here ready to be healed. So this poem's called Learned to Live. Who were my summer friends that appeared stranger the closer we became? Picture in chalk a flash cross-section, a biopsy of random backgrounds, plugging up blue sky in the atrium at the center, as if we'd stepped off an elevator after being stuck inside for a month or two, as if we were just short of eating one another and laughing about it. Bonds, untouched mortals can only imagine, forged in fear of just about everything but our deepened humanity. These days, I'm smiling more broadly, swaying with the palm trees. With each trip around the sun, there's a more profound patina on our prospects, a soul surface. It blinds me to the limits of setting our sights. For each of us who had failed to kill ourselves learned to live.
It's a poem about hope.
Yes. Hope is very important. In fact, we here at the counseling center, we speak. People come to us for help, and our job is for them to immediately feel hope, because that's such an important thing.
Rex, you talk about the relationship between empathy and mental health recovery. So I want to ask you this question. For someone who wants to help someone else, and that someone else may be in a dark place, what's the best way for that person to be empathetic?
I think to understand and to communicate that you understand, that you care. This is something the author and someone of whom I'm a fan, Judith Orloff, talks about. The idea that I care about you and communicate that I care about you. Because when you use empathy, you don't have to know this person. They just have to feel that they matter, that they count. And that's the best thing that you can do, is say, I'm here for you, and I'm here for you now, and you matter, and your health matters, and what I can do for you matters. It's being here. It's being here for the other. I think I wrote down here, using here as a verb, like I hear you, you hear me, your presence is a present. That's what I wrote down.
Rex, you're allowing your royalties received from your work to benefit a crisis counseling center for those in need. Why was it important for you to do that?
I am the luckiest human being on the planet. If there's nothing too much I can give to mental health and to help the many, many people, I think it's 1 in 5 people suffer with some kind of mental illness, which means everyone is touched with it. And it doesn't have to be important. It goes without saying that anything I can do to help, I will do.
You have an upcoming book called Rare Fuel. What's that about?
Rare Fuel is a little different from A Quiet Place to Land, which is filled with beautiful photos. It's very much about being mindful, or don't they say now, being mindful and demure. And it's a feel-good book. What Rare Fuel is about, it's about my experience. It's all poetry, and it's raw. And there's some things that could make some people say, oh, my God, it was awful. That was terrible. Well, how can you talk about that? And it's not necessarily the poem I read had this feeling of hope, but many don't. And my publishers kept saying, you know, it's important that people who are suffering know that they are seen, that their experience has been felt by someone else. And if you look on the back of the book, you know that this person got out alive. And so eventually it gives you hope. But the book is, I wouldn't call it dark, but it hurts. It hurts to read about it. It hurts for people that care about me to know what I went through. But it was a gift also to be able to get the words to write about it and to be able to live to talk about it.
Rex, there could be some people listening that are uncomfortable hearing us talk about suicide. What would you tell them about whether it's important to talk about suicide?
Everything I know tells me that you must talk about it. You must let people know that you hurt, that perhaps you have suicidal ideation, you've thought about it, or you're falling into a dark place, or something is not right if you don't talk about it. If you don't reach out a little bit, no one can reach out to you. I know that ideally someone in your life is saying, how are you? To me, how are you, Rex? Or if I was a good interviewee, I would say, how are you, Craig? And you would answer me. And because I don't know, I'm hoping you're okay today. But that's the important thing, to make the conversation happen. And don't, do you know, it's been proven, or it's supposedly been proven, that the average person takes 10 years between the time they feel the need for help and the time they reach out.
That's too long. That's too long.
It's a crime, and people of all ages lose their lives because of their reticence to reach out.
Rex Wilder, it's been a pleasure. He's an award-winning poet, photographer, and mental breakdown survivor turned mental health advocate, and he's not afraid to talk about it. His book, A Quiet Place to Land, has been called a mental wellness coffee table book by the National Alliance on Mental Illness. He's got an upcoming book that he's talked about here today called Rare Fuel. One more time, Rex, if you or anyone that you care about is in crisis, we're imploring you to please know that you're not alone. Reach out right now by calling 988. It's the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Your life matters, and help is just a call away. And as Rex says, reach out. Rex, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
The answers are not simple, and so I feel the pain of the people who are trying to find the answers. But it's so great what you're doing, and thank you so much for the opportunity.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 30th. The University of North Dakota's 1912 Dakota Yearbook reported that President Edward Robertson of Wesley College envisioned Sayre Hall, the men's dormitory, as a place, quote, where tossing, stretching, room stacking, and other relics of barbarism intended to strike terror into freshmen would have no place, for the founder had high ideals. The yearbook continued. The knowing ones shook their heads and murmured, wait and see. Time will tell. Wesley College, a school associated with the Methodist Episcopal Church, had moved to Grand Forks from Wahpeton, becoming affiliated with UND, where a very different take on hazing came the following year. A report published in The Student, UND's student newspaper, described the annual hazing of freshmen from Budge Hall, calling it a very delightful evening's entertainment. An automobile light was on so that the women of Davis Hall, the site of Gamble Hall today, could watch their male classmates being whipped with blankets and beaten with paddles. Later, the whole company paid President McVeigh a visit, at which time President McVeigh delivered a speech, which the student newspaper described as emphasizing the importance of good fellowship, which is the underlying tone of the right sort of initiation. With President McVeigh's blessing, the mob then crossed University Avenue and invaded Sayre Hall at Wesley College. The student reported, at Sayre, the men already initiated were pressed into service, wielding the blanket. The lights at Larimore Hall, the women's dormitory at Wesley College, were turned on so the women could, again, watch their male classmates being whipped with blankets and beaten with paddles. The freshmen were forced to make degrading yells and sing humiliating songs. Such hazing apparently continued throughout UND President McVeigh's administration. Today, the university and all of the UND fraternity chapters do not condone or tolerate hazing of any kind. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Andrew Alexis Varvel. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Monday's edition of Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll take a look at being wrong. It's our monthly philosophical courage discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. We made an error the last time we two visited, and we'll talk about what that means. And Measure 4 is on this November's ballot. It's an important topic and may eliminate property taxes here in North Dakota, but there are ramifications. We hope you can join us again tomorrow, right here on Main Street.